Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
I am very much interested in going to Cuba, but I think the conditions have to be right.
That's President Obama last December speaking with Yahoo News. This week, the White House announced the president will be going to Cuba for 2 days in March. The subtext of the decision? The president must believe conditions in Cuba have changed enough to warrant his visit.
And what I've said to the Cuban government is if, in fact, I with confidence can say that we're seeing some progress in the liberty and freedom and possibilities of ordinary Cubans, I'd love to use a visit as a way of highlighting that progress.
Again, President Obama last December setting the stage for today, this week's announcement. The decision this week for this presidential trip to Cuba comes with all the historic overtones that have accompanied the changing relationship between America and Cuba since late 2014, when the president announced a new strategy of engagement. And of course, this announcement this week also came with the familiar criticism of the efforts. Miami Republican Congresswoman Ileana Ross-Layton told WLRN why she opposes the president's upcoming visit.
I'm really disappointed that the president is going to Cuba right now when there's been a massive increase in the number of detentions, arbitrary arrests. So I think it's the wrong time for the wrong reasons, and I think it's a slap in the face to all the victims of the tyranny. We're demanding nothing of the Castro regime. Things will go on as always.
Is this the wrong time for President Obama's visit to Cuba? What are the right conditions the president said would lead him to visit, and do they really exist on the island today? If you have family in Cuba, what would you want President Obama to know about their lives for his upcoming visit to the communist nation? Let us know here as we begin once again with Cuba and the upcoming presidential visit to that communist island here on the Florida Roundup. The phone number, 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. You can find us all over social media as well, at WLRN on Twitter. Look for us on Facebook at facebook.com/group/TheFloridaRoundup. Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us here at WLRN. Louise Clemens is NPR's senior editor for diversity with us from Washington, D.C. Tim, let's begin here in South Florida. Using the president's own criteria that we just laid out, have conditions changed in Cuba since reestablishing relations?
Well, certainly not as overtly as the opponents of normalization with Cuba would demand. You didn't see anything since his comments in December that reflect, for example, reforms like freer political speech or multi-party elections or giving Cubans full access to the internet. So you didn't see those overt things. I think what Obama and his supporters would argue is that we are seeing perhaps more under the surface changes. Congresswoman Ross-Layton in there just mentioned arrests. Well, the fact is that the arrests that we're seeing in Cuba these days are not of the long term, 20-year jail sentences that create all this horde of political prisoners. You're seeing much more short term, hours long, day long detentions, for example. And on the economic side, we're certainly seeing a robust interest in entrepreneurialism on the part of Cubans that Raul Castro is allowing more of. So I think. What Obama's rationale was, we're seeing just enough change for him to go there, to warrant him going there to help accelerate that change.
Let's go to Havana. Dan Trotta is in Havana with Reuters with us on the telephone. Dan, how about that? What are the conditions that you've been able to identify that have changed since the re-engagement policy came into full force?
Cuba tends to move very slowly and very deliberately all the time, and that hasn't changed since the announcement of December 2014. So in the context, looking at it from the rest of the world, you see Cuba is pretty much standing still. But in that Cuban context, the changes here have been quite significant, quite dramatic. And so just the fact that Obama's coming at all, I think, is quite telling. I think Tim is genuinely right that there's no significant changes in terms of democracy or human rights, nor would we expect that to happen overnight.
Louise Clemens, NPR senior editor for diversity with us from Washington. What about the political change, the political climate change here in the United States? How has that changed, giving the White House the ambition and the on-ramp to go to Cuba?
You know, I think ambition is the key word in your question. I think it's the ambition of a second-term president in his final year trying to establish his legacy. And he feels that the normalization of U.S. policy, of U.S. relations with Cuba, will be an important part of that. What has changed in terms of political climate is that we have an intensifying Republican campaign where we have two strong, viable Cuban-American candidates who oppose the president's policy. And if either one ends up being elected president, you could expect many of these policies to be reversed.
Luis is spot on. And that's also one of the considerations we have to take into account when it comes to why aren't the Cubans changing more. Sources I talk to who are in touch with the Cubans often point out that they too are worried about this presidential election, and if they even if they had the desire to make the changes, they're sort of holding back because they want to see what's going to be the outcome of this presidential election and whether or not this normalization process is even going to continue past 2016.
Dan Trotta with Reuters in Havana, how was this announcement greeted in Havana amongst the official ranks, but also amongst civil society?
People in general, very positive. There is a certain segment of the dissidents who are against engagement and have opposed this all along and say they really don't want Obama to come unless he makes a more forceful statement in support of human rights and change within Cuba. But that's not the way things work. Obama's not going to come here and embarrass his host. He'll make some strong statements, but it's all going to be within the parameters of what Cuba expects. And the Cubans can tolerate, certainly, dissent and criticism. They do all the time. People can say pretty much anything they want. Now, of course, the big problem is when you get 10 people together to go say it down in the square, then they'll take you off to jail for a few hours. But I think officially, they're thrilled to have Obama here. I think that it offers them a legitimacy that they've been looking for.
Which is amongst the criticisms, of course, with the hardliners that we hear in South Florida and elsewhere, that this presidential visit legitimizes the Castro regime in a way that it hasn't been for the better part of a half century in terms of international diplomacy with the United States. The president has even acknowledged his ability or his want to use a state visit like this to accelerate change. Again, the president's comments back in December to Yahoo News.
I found that a lot of times when I go on a visit, not only is there a fresh coat of paint on all the buildings along my route, but metaphorically, I think there's an interest on the part of the government to spruce things up.
So perhaps not even metaphorically to spruce things up. Dan, what will the president find in Cuba in terms of human relations, in terms of human rights, in terms of the push toward more liberties in Cuba? That is the unstated desire, of course, of the economic engagement that's taken place on the part of the United States.
Well, first of all, I don't think there's enough paint in the world to cover what's needed here in Havana.
Yep.
Look, I think the more of the point really is how much Obama can do in his final year, given the realities of Cuba. I mean, I think that again, you're going to find people here welcoming him. You're going to hear chants of "Viva Obama." You'll likely hear chants of "Viva Estados Unidos." So, it is true what he said, that beyond the coat of paint, that metaphorically, it will add a new dimension to Cuba and its views of the United States.
Luis Clemens, I want to ask you about that because we've seen some public polling out of Cuba that shows extreme popularity on the part of the president. Certainly, a level of popularity for President Obama in Cuba that rivals even the Pope and the Catholic Church.
Yeah, it's not surprising. People in Cuba, look, I first went to cover news in Cuba, almost 20 years ago. And there was a real desire even back then for a real appetite for the reestablishment of normal relations between the two countries. that President Obama should be the one to go ahead and provide that final push explains why he's so popular in Cuba.
And we've heard that kind of endorsement of the trip from the Democratic side here in South Florida. Former Democratic Congressman Joe Garcia laid out just yesterday why he believes this presidential visit will change on the island.
Barack Obama is 20 points more popular than any leader within Cuba. He gives hope to millions of Cubans who have wanted a change. And the reality is things have changed. You're seeing more civil society, more space, more dissident groups, small businesses, entrepreneurs, and we've got to give those people more oxygen, more opportunity so that they can carve a space for themselves in Cuba.
Yeah, the point that Joe makes, I think, is a valid one. When I talked to Congresswoman Ross Layton yesterday, one of the points she made was, look, how can Obama do what three popes haven't done with their visits already? Well, you're talking about three very old white men coming to an island that I think is going to connect much more effectively with a young African-American president coming and showing this very stark contrast with an octogenarian leader in the person of Raul Castro. Mm-hmm. And I think there could be a difference in that sense.
But what could this impact the negotiations behind the scenes or in public about a real congressional change to the approach of the United States and Cuba? What we've seen is a change in the administrative approach, right? You know, with the ability for commercial aircraft now to fly back and forth. We just announced this week that an Alabama tractor company is going to build a factory in Cuba from the United States. These are administrative changes. The congressional change is locked in the trade
embargo. And that's the linchpin. Nothing is really going to change or go that much forward with regards to normalization until the trade embargo is lifted.
Tim Padgett, covering the Americas for us here at WLRN. Luis Clemens is with NPR with us from Washington, and Dan Trotta with Reuters with us from Havana, Cuba. Your phone calls now. Let's begin in West Palm Beach with Richard. Richard, welcome to the roundup. Go ahead.
Hello. I think that it's about time that we establish normalized relationships with Cuba. When we make a fair comparison, we've bent over backwards to work with China, the big communist country, and we can't, and we're looking at similar civil rights problems in China as in Cuba. I think Cuba's in our backyard, and we should reach out to them. And I applaud Obama on his efforts to do so. And I think that the criticism is from people who are really outdated in their ideas first. And secondly, there's always a criticism to anything that Obama is trying to do. So I really applaud what he's done, and I agree with the conversation and support you guys. Great radio station. Great ideas.
Hey,
NPR.
Richard, thank you so much. We appreciate it. Let's go to the mothership at NPR. Luis Clemens, will respond to Richard. You know, we've heard the supporters of the reengagement with Cuba point to China and the economic relations that America has, points to Vietnam with the reestablishment of diplomatic relations and economic relations after the Vietnam War, and look at the Vietnamese economy and how it has taken off because of its reengagement in the global scale as cases for new diplomacy, new engagement with the communist island.
Look, Tom, I'm Cuban-American, so take what I'm about to say with a grain of salt. I know my people, and we consider ourselves special and unique in a way that that determines these sort of kinds of changes. What I mean by this, many people see this as a relic of the Cold War, but this is very personal for many people in South Florida. The gentleman caller referred to outdated. Well, if you've spent 50 years, 40 years, 20 years, 10 years away from the island because of your political beliefs, because you want to have the right to gather with nine other people and say what you want on the streets of Havana, it doesn't feel outdated at all. It feels personal. I say that not as justification or an expression of support to policy one way or another. I say that as a way of helping explain why this policy has persisted.
And we, Luis, when Pope Francis was making his trip there, we spoke with the with the head of the Archdiocese here in Miami, Thomas Winski, about this trip. And this was Archbishop Winski's third trip, of course, third papal trip that he was going to accompany the Pope to Cuba. And Tim, the Archbishop here in Miami, spoke about how the papal visit really was an opportunity for forgiveness, an opportunity not only for diplomatic re-engagement, faith re-engagement,
but an opportunity to heal.
No, and I agree with Luis completely. I think the subtext of Archbishop Wenske's comments, though, was while that anger, that personal anger that Luis describes, is justified and understandable, it doesn't necessarily create good foreign policy. And I think that's the juncture that we're at right now with Obama's efforts to normalize. We're sort of leaving that personal politics behind, and now sort of going toward more judicious foreign policy.
A couple of comments coming in from the Public Insight Network here at WLRN. Robert at Coral Gables wrote us, his visit will instill passion, hope, and opportunity for all Cubans to move slowly but surely toward a more normal life, more freedom of self-expression and speech. Eric wrote us, noting that he's of Cuban descent, saying the isolationism that Republicans always instill support allows regimes like these to operate without any accountability. And Juan, also noting he's of Cuban descent, wrote us in regards to his thoughts on the upcoming presidential visit to Cuba and expectations. He wrote, zero, nada, zilch. Let's go to Fort Lauderdale, where Ainsworth is joining the roundup. Go ahead. Welcome to the program.
Hello?
Yes, Ainsworth. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, thank you very much for taking my call. I just want to make a few quick comments. I don't want to hold up the hair. But I want to say that most of the people that left Cuba are mostly white, and they don't want to see any changes whatsoever, because when they run away from Cuba and they came to America, they get millions of dollars. And especially those Cubans who are living down in Miami, they quickly to accept those Cubans coming over because they know that they're going to be money in their pocket. Over 50 years, there has been stagnation in Cuba. Now, at some point, someone has to make that change. And of all those 43% within the United States of America, they have not made any change. And Barack Obama come, he run on making a change, and everything that boils down to the end is politics. And the Republican Party are full of rhetoric, especially Marco Rubio make a statement the other day. He was on his campaign and he stated that he is sending a message to the people of Cuba, mm-hmm. that if he is elected, that he will keep Guantanamo for life.
Well, Ainsworth, just to clear up a couple of misconceptions, not all 43 presidents of the United States have had an isolationism policy toward Cuba. In fact, I believe it was Calvin Coolidge in 1928 who actually last visited Cuba.
Right.
So just to clear up some of that, Guantanamo has been and it continues to be United States property of the U.S. military. And the president has talked about that, and other supporters of his reengagement have talked about that kind of situation continuing. But I want to pick up on this idea of a role of race. And Dan Trotta with Reuters in Havana, let me put it to you. Is there a race component that is being talked about in Cuba with this upcoming presidential race, but even more generally with the reengagement from the United States being directed from this Obama administration?
Yes to both questions. First of all, there is an affinity to Obama. They call him here El Mulatico, in a positive sense, I mean, in a term of endearment. And so that does have an impact in his family as well. But also, yes, there is a race component here in the sense that in the early years, it was predominantly white, wealthy Cubans who left, who established themselves in South Florida and have built wealth over the generations in the United States. So therefore, they are the ones who are more apt to send money back home. So it's white Cuban relatives here who are getting that money. It's those Cuban Americans who are now spending more and more time back in Cuba who are setting up private restaurants and private homes, inns in their homes for people to stay. So in the growing private sector, it's been those white Cubans who have been better able to take advantage of it. So while the removing the limits on remittances and other measures that Obama has taken have been very important for injecting money into the private sector in Cuba, it has also had the impact of exacerbating the inequality, wealth inequality, yep, between Afro-Cubans and the rest.
Dan, let me squeeze in one more phone call here. Sylvia is joining us from Miami. Go ahead, Sylvia.
Yes, hi. I feel like Obama going to see the Castros is lending support to an illegitimate government. We must remember that this government was never supported by the people. They were never elected. It was 60 years almost a coup d'etat.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel Obama is pretty much befriending a communist dictatorship.
You don't support the presidential visit coming up next month?
No, I don't, because it's lending support to a illegitimate government that has oppressed one of the greatest violators of human rights. And being a Cuban American, I feel really sad. All those people who think that we only care about money, we care about the people.
Yeah.
We want them to live in dignity. And for 60 years, they've been denied this. And they've caused so much harm to families. So many people have suffered physically, emotionally, psychologically. I mean, this is a dictatorship. It's one of the most brutal. And to see Obama going there, warming up to this Castro and his regime, it's really offensive and sad that we have the U.S. doing that.
Sylvia, we appreciate you joining us here and giving us that perspective. Luis Clemens with NPR of Cuban descent, as you said, Luis, it's a real mix of emotions that you've heard here in just the past 10 minutes from callers.
Oh, it makes me miss Miami all the more. that's the wonderful thing, and to me that's a fascinating thing, because there are elements of truth to various things referenced here.
Yep.
Racial dynamics, very real in Cuba and in South Florida. A lot of separated families feeling a lot of pain, burdens being felt by the community in Cuban-American community in Miami. Those are realities, and you can talk about the policy, you can talk about the politics, but it's hard to move hearts and minds of those who feel wronged.
Yeah, it gets down to the people, no doubt about it. Luis Clemens is with NPR with us in Washington, where he's the senior editor for diversity and a former South Floridian himself. Welcome back anytime, Luis. You know that. Tim Patchett covering the Americas for us here at WLRN. And in Havana, Cuba with Reuters is Dan Trotta. Thanks to all three of you for joining us this week on the Florida Roundup.
Thank you.
Program still still to come here. Physics facing financial reality. It's the money trouble of Miami's Science Museum and the fate of a taxpayer bailout. That's next. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. South Florida likes to brag about its rich cultural life. There are the performing arts centers near our downtowns, a calendar filled with art festivals and art gallery openings, and millions of dollars in voter-approved borrowing to buy and build cultural institutions. 4 years ago, shovels went into the dirt where Biscayne Boulevard ducks under the MacArthur Causeway on the mainland. It was a project to build a second museum next to the Perez Art Museum Miami in an effort to create a campus. The strategy was to take two existing cultural institutions, rebuild and rename them in the effort to play host to some world-class cultural institutions. And the effort would use millions of taxpayer dollars to get the ambition and the ambitious building off the ground. This was the sound of dump trucks and bulldozers during the building of the Patricia and Philip Frost Museum of Science back in May of 2013, a little more than a year after that groundbreaking. The building was just starting to take shape back then, including what has become its centerpiece, two-story aquarium sphere. Back then, optimism was running high when I spoke with the museum's CEO, Jillian Thomas.
What is the message that this development sends to the for-profit development community, do you think?
We can do it better.
Since then, the money, it's been running out. The museum needs to raise cash to finish the work. Do you support more money, more taxpayer money for the Frost Museum of Science? Did you visit the old museum in Coconut Grove? Have you donated for the new building? Are you satisfied with its progress? You've certainly been watching it go up on the shores of Biscayne Bay. Has Miami's philanthropy failed? Join us here on the Florida Roundup, 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. Jillian Thomas, the CEO of the Frost Museum of Science, joins us on the Florida Roundup. Jillian, welcome back. You heard your comments back in May of 2013. What do you think today?
I think we have to wait till you see it finished.
In terms of whether or not you do it better than the for-profit developers.
I think so, yeah. Yes.
How much money is the museum short to finish the
finish the final product?
Well, as you know, we're working now with the county to really achieve our final vision, and that will be going to the county quite soon. And that will give us enough to get to opening, which should be really wonderful.
Which is, I think, somewhere between $100 and $120 million?
No, it isn't as much as that. So to get to opening is about another $85
million. $85
million
all in.
Correct.
We'll get the doors opened.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And then we'll continue to fundraise both in order to maintain our great open access program so everybody can have access to it, and also to make sure we have continuing exciting new things coming along as we go along. It really is a wonderful museum. I do really want to just make sure everybody realises we are talking about the next version of that museum that everybody loved for such a long time in Coconut Grove. It's been a real treasure in the community, and it's given a lot back to the community and had enormous support. So I think that's a very important aspect.
Has the community failed the museum in not providing the dollars in order to get it completed on time?
I don't think so. I think it's just one of these things of time. It's taking time to get there a little longer than we thought. So we've had enormous support both at the old museum from all the community groups that we had, like the patrons and the guild and the Latin American friends, and now we have the young patrons. Our board before has been very supportive, and our new board going forward. So I don't think it's failed. I just think it's taking a longer time than we anticipated.
Why the shortfall? Why the $85 million shortfall in order to get the building
built? There's two components of that. So it isn't, I wouldn't describe it as a shortfall in total. So one component of that is that we have pledges that are there over time. That's a very normal process. They don't all necessarily come in exactly in parallel with when the needs are. So 40 million of that is from pledges that are due post-opening. So that's what we have already promised by people that will come in over a period of time. So you take a borrow against those pledges. Mm-hmm. There is the other 45 million gap that is the funding that we're talking about, but
and that's where the county is offering to step in.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And we're very appreciative of the work that everybody's doing. But I would just think this is a real community effort in order to get there, and it will be something that will be a treasure for decades ahead.
Are you willing to put a date on a calendar for ribbon cutting?
We're not putting a date on a calendar for ribbon cutting yet. We have, of course, to get all the agreements signed, and then we'll be doing that.
The loan agreements and the grant agreements. Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
It's all dependent one on the other.
Doug Hanks, from our partner, the Miami Herald, with us covering Miami County government, and you've covered the Frost Museum here. What has been the county contribution so far to the museum?
The county contribution, which was approved in 2004, they call it a bond issue, the voters approved borrowing against property taxes, was $165 billion towards construction that will be borrowed against property taxes. So the cost is much more over 30 years.
Yep.
And when the Frost fell short on construction cash, came to Mayor Jimenez, and Mayor Jimenez, as I'm told very reluctantly, agreed to what we call the bailout, which is Miami-Dade County will borrow an additional $45 million. This will be paid back from hotel taxes, and that hotel taxes is what his administration had sort of planned to give the Frost as an operating subsidy each year, which would have been $4 million a year.
And I want to talk about the ongoing operating expenses in a second. Jillian Thomas, the CEO of Frost, with us here on the Florida Roundup. The $45 million that appears to be in the pipeline from borrowed county dollars here, Jillian, to the $85 million you need to complete construction.
That's in it, yep.
Have you had to change architectural plans in order to meet the $85 million that you seem to be able to be within your grasp?
Architectural plans, no, because the building is well underway to completion. We're delaying some of the fit-out components, and that's
such
what
as?
We're doing. For the moment, we don't have the projected projections on the outside of the planetarium is one example. There's some external space that we want to develop as a community gathering place before the ticketing area, and we don't currently have a donor for that. So if there's anybody listening that wants to give me somewhere between 3 and 5 million, I can finish that off and have lots of really great exhibits for everybody to enjoy and a big wall that we could do projections on. So there's a number of components that if we're to do everything we ever thought of that we'd really love to do that everybody could enjoy, we will continue to try and see if we can achieve those. But what we're confident of is that with the $85 million, we can get to opening and have a really spectacular, world-class exhibition, planetarium, aquarium, everything that we want. Another thing, can I just correct something you said earlier on as well? Yes. So the four main components are a planetarium, the Living Core Aquarium, and two big other areas of exhibition and learning spaces. The ball is the planetarium.
My mistake.
That's
yes,
right. The
sphere,
Living Core
yes.
Aquarium is that ship-shaped building in the front,
right,
which takes you on a wonderful journey from the Everglades to the ocean, and with a lot of interactive exhibits and multimedia as well.
Thank you for the correction. Yep. I appreciate that very much, Gillian.
Because people just see the back, you know, so they don't think they've seen it. And we want to make sure people do actually know what's inside it, what's coming along, and also have a kind of taste of it beforehand.
And what's inside of it are $210 million of taxpayer dollars here at the end of the day. $165 million plus $45. That's my back of the envelope math. Check me on that, Doug Hanks, will you?
Right. That's what's being contributed to the construction effort. It would be much more when you're paying the interest.
Right. And that's what I wanted to get. These are structured as loans against current tax collections.
Correct.
This is not an outright grant of sorts.
It's a grant to us.
It's a grant to you.
But the county is borrowing the money to produce that construction cash.
Right.
And we will be bringing in, because of the size and the impact of what we're doing, a large number of tourists will be coming in and spending money in the county.
So this gets right to the point of the operating cost. The county bailout here, the $45 million, Gillian, is structured in a way that it will not be providing money over the course of several years in order to keep the doors open. So thus, will the museum have to be self-sufficient?
Of course, we'd always have to be able to stand on our own 2 feet, and there's always different sources of revenue that you try and balance between them.
Sure,
right?
Performing arts centers and other public cultural institutions get a county subsidy. Currently, what you're saying is you'll be able to operate year to year with no county subsidy.
That's what we're saying. And that if I could just expand on that a little bit more.
Yeah.
There are several sources of funding for any kind of cultural institution, right? So as well as ticket funding, you have the donations that you receive, and you also have the things like facility rentals and event rentals and those kinds of components. So when we were trying to develop the new museum, we spent a lot of time thinking about what were the things that people loved in the community? How could we rethink those for the future, right? So one of those components is the Living Core Aquarium, right? Because we've always had really popular, many people remember the wonderful summer camps doing marine science. And here we have the aquarium that takes you on that journey from the Everglades to the ocean. And the point about that is that a much broader number of people really enjoy aquaria than enjoy science centers. So by having an aquarium as a key component, we increase and broaden the appeal across the community and therefore get people into a first taste of science and technology that can lead them on to physics. So our short lesson for that is people are not frightened of fish, though they might be a physics. So that's one component,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That enables us to have a much larger number of visitors and be more financially viable.
And I want to spend a little bit of time here, Gillian, real quick before you move on, because this was exactly the focus, Doug Hanks, of a piece that you wrote, in fact, this week and published in the Miami Herald, talking about some of the ambitious audience numbers and ticket price increases that are built into the Science Museum's business plan.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, in the story we characterize it as an ambitious, aggressive plan, massive increase in attendance, higher ticket prices would be the most popular tourist attraction or the most popular attraction downtown.
And second biggest in the county after the zoo.
According to what they said the zoo attendance numbers were. So, I mean, that's obviously going to be the big test. That business plan was created at a time when there was, if you listen to the county, a plan to get $4 million a year that would just go straight to subsidize operations. Yeah. So certainly it's a big challenge, and that'll be the test is what will be the support once it opens. It's going to be spectacular, clearly. Will it have the staying power? I mean, that's always the test for these things.
Indeed, I agree with that.
Are you sticking with those expectations of attendance going from 170,000 in the Grove to 750,000 downtown?
Yes.
Ticket costs from $15 to $27 with a discount for Miami-Dade County residents. All that expectation
stays. We have not
finalized
the ticket price, but that is in the range that we have. When we've had the study done by outside experts, they're called consulting firm, that have worked also for the Perez Art Museum and other people in town, which has come up with the numbers. They did comparisons around the country. We took into account things like there's a California Academy of Science that also has an aquarium and planetarium. It's very rare, the combination that we've got. We took into account that California has a much higher median income level than here. So we've looked at all those sorts of things. We've done the really best planning with the best advice we can. I think it's important to get to opening, and then we'll work on it for the future. There's another component as well, though, if I may just add in.
Yes.
That is part of the thinking from the county, which is that to date we've been focusing exclusively on our exhibitions and the building in terms of fundraising, right? And we've also had our ongoing programs. But as we get this step up in terms of getting the front funding for the capital funding, some of our future success in funding will go into supporting the programs and the ongoing operational costs. So it enables us to also really start highlighting what we need to do to keep those operational costs going forward rather than waiting until we get to opening. And that's a very sensible wish of the county and something that obviously we're going to pursue very actively, because we attach a lot of importance to making it something that people can come to and can afford.
I was just going to make the point that, you know, there's not many major cultural institutions in Miami that don't really rely on some sort of county support.
Right.
True with sports arenas as well. So
it's not exclusive to Miami-Dade and South Florida either. Right.
But the point I was going to make is I feel like this really does capture the notion that when the government makes a big investment in a project, the government's really going to sort of own that in the future. And you hear, hey, we could not let this fail. We could not let this shutter. And I think the county is now sort of fulfilling that tacit obligation from when it agreed to help build it, that, hey, we're going to be there to support it as well. Now, that's the controversy, because there's a lot of demands on those government dollars for other places, and that's the debate.
And that gets to our first phone call here, as Stephen from Homestead is joining the Florida Roundup, talking about the Frost Museum of Science and the financing and physics there coming together. Stephen, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Thank you. And also, I will like to say that I support the arts. I support taxpayer supporting of the arts and history and sciences. But you had earlier a clip of the president and CEO saying that something about $210 million worth of taxpayer funded, and then they're running out of money in 2013, something like that.
Well, just to be clear, it was $165 million initially of county money. There'll be $45 million of new county money coming in order to complete the construction. Jillian, do I have that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And but I would also like to say, at the end of the day, I'm 26 years old. I'm a homeowner. I am what the future of what y'all want to bring to see your museum and everything else, my children. But I also want to say, don't be arrogant in assuming that us taxpayers will be happy with y'all running out of money so quickly.
No.
Use it wisely.
I agree.
What kind of assurances could you give to Stephen, a new young homeowner?
Thank you, guys.
With that, thank you, Stephen.
I'll get off the air.
Who's got multi-decades of property tax payments ahead of him?
I know that. One of our changes that's happening is that we are going to have county and city representation on our board.
Yeah.
So they will have very close involvement in what we're doing as going forward. And I hope we'll make wise choices as we go ahead. I think that's something that's very important, that we look after everything that we do with public money and with donors' money as well, the very best of our ability.
Finally, Jillian, I want to get your thoughts on this idea of how Miami Philanthropy has treated the museum. Dr. Frost, of course, came forward with a significant contribution.
Mm-hmm.
He's talked about a bridge loan even in this cash crunch that the museum mm-hmm. is experiencing during this construction phase. You've got forward donations, mm-hmm. but, you know, as Miami brags about its cultural depth,
mm-hmm.
has local philanthropy failed in this case in order to provide the resources necessary, or was the plan too ambitious for the timing?
I think I'd like to just come at that a slightly different angle, which is that I think all the donors in Miami support many different things, right? And that's what's so wonderful about the community of donors we have here. There's a very, very many generous people. I think science comes into a slightly different category to the arts, because people have something in the arts that they love, the opera, the ballet, and they know that that needs support. Science, because it has such a broad appeal to so many people, I think many people sort of feel that like somebody else should be looking after it, that it should be covered by something, you know? It's not necessarily so easy to generate that sense that science is the one thing for you.
I will say that the irony is not lost on me that I asked that question mm-hmm. on public radio, mm-hmm. public media in South Florida either. Jillian Thomas, thank you for coming in, the CEO mm-hmm. of the Frost Museum of Science, and Doug Hanks with our partner, the Miami Herald. Stick around. We got more to talk about with you, including the spectacular highway crash this week and paying for better transportation throughout South Florida. That's next.
We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Around 5 o'clock this past Monday afternoon, Kasim Smith was driving his City of Miami garbage truck south on Interstate 95. He was on the exit ramp to Southwest 7th Street when something happened. The multi-ton truck turned and smashed through a concrete barrier. The truck and the driver were sent 80 feet down, plunging to the street below. Well, thankfully, nobody was hurt except for the driver, critically injured. But the spectacular nature of the crash, a truck flying off an exit ramp 80 feet above the ground, raises some serious questions about highway and driver safety. Now, in the meantime, north in Broward County, voters there may get a chance to decide if they want to spend more money on transportation to make it safer and more efficient. A referendum that would raise the county sales tax by one penny per dollar could be on the November ballot. We talk here about transportation on the Florida Roundup now. Doug Hank's still with us from our partner, the Miami Herald, and Brittany Wallman from the South Florida Sun-Sentinel with us via Skype. Doug, let's begin with this crash. What's the latest on the investigation? What do we know? Any sense of what may have happened, and what's the evidence that investigators are going to be able to get their hands on and their eyes on?
Well, you know, my piece of this story was looking at the structural fortitude of the railing on 95 that the truck breached and sent the vehicle crashing into the park. And what FDOT, Florida Department of Transportation, told us was that was a very old design. It's not out of it's still acceptable, and they're going to replace it with the same sort of fence post design. Mm. But if they were retrofitting the whole bridge, if they were building it new, they would not use that design. Instead of a fence, they would use the solid barrier, which to me raised an interesting question, is would that truck have been deflected if it was the more up-to-date solid barrier? Now, of course, they say, hey, this was a freak accident. You know, there's no guarantee, but it was a pretty crazy situation to have this truck fall from the sky.
80 feet
and
down.
It happened to be a 1969 design.
Yeah, old design. I mean, are they looking in the tensile strength, the design flaw, concrete makeup?
I'm sure they're looking at all that. And FDOT says they're going to keep looking. And I'm sure that there's going to be a lot of pressure to get some answers. And I'm also sure City of Miami is not thrilled to have this city park underneath this essentially I-95 bridge.
Jose Marti Park, which is where the truck landed right in front of the clubhouse, essentially.
Which could have been such an epic disaster if it hadn't been President's Day. That was right next to a daycare center.
Yep. 5 o'clock.
5 o'clock.
Rush hour.
Big after-school program there. Yep. When the media arrived, we were sort of on the other side of the chain-link fence, and all the photos and video footage of the truck, you had to shoot through a swing set to get there. I mean, it was such a bad situation. Big miracle that the driver wasn't killed on impact.
Yeah.
And big miracle that no one else was there.
Seriously injured. Let's not make
it
to be any more serious for him and his family, certainly. But questions also about driver safety, and there's questions about some metrics on the truck itself that had been outfitted with potential video cameras.
Yeah, it's so interesting that the City of Miami has what we are calling a black box, some sort of surveillance for drivers, because they were getting complaints about driver misconduct on these city garbage trucks. So we're just waiting to hear the results on that. It's been sent to California. The vendor's going to analyze it and see what happens.
Lots of unanswered questions still with this spectacular crash. In the meantime, lots of unanswered questions about whether or not Broward County voters will decide whether or not to spend more money on transportation. Brittany Wallman with us via Skype. She's with the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. What is the status of a potential voter referendum asking Broward residents to spend more via sales tax for these dollars to go to transportation? Will this be on the ballot in November?
Well, we will know for sure in about a month, but it does appear likely that will be at least one ballot initiative for a penny. There could be more than one because they're sort of dueling city-county initiatives, but I would expect to see at least one penny on there for transportation.
So let me sort this out. Brittany, let me sort this out a little bit. What you're saying is there could be multiple penny increase requests on the ballot. Adding up, you could have two or 3 cents added per dollar for sales tax for transportation if they all are on the ballot and all approved?
You could potentially have two. One would be transportation, and that would be levied by, that would go to county, and the other would be infrastructure, which the cities would get the vast majority of, and it could also be used for transportation. But I think everyone's in agreement that that would assure the defeat of both initiatives.
Yeah, wow.
So it's really just giving the cities leverage to say, county, promise us some of the dollars from this transportation penny, if it passes, and that's a big if.
Yeah, if it passes, if it's even on the referendum. So what kind of pathway does it have to the November referendum? What kind of opposition would it face?
Well, there's a lot of support, believe it or not, from the business community. Now, Broward voters have a history of defeating sales tax initiatives. This will be the fourth one. The last three failed. But the business community is very much in favor and will probably spend money campaigning for this sales tax increase. The county commission is going to meet with cities in March, and the ballot language is due June 20th. Mm-hmm. So at this point, there's no plan. They will have to hurry, get a plan together, convince voters that this is going to change my life behind the wheel, and then we'll see what happens.
Change the life of Broward residents behind the wheel. Broward, of course, doesn't have really commuter rail to speak of. Certainly Tri-Rail runs through the county, but it doesn't have a Metro Rail type of system. It's got a bus system. It's got a trolley system. Brittany, where would these dollars presumably be spent if voters approve them to be collected in the first place?
Well, there's no really transformational or revolutionary, sexy item that's being talked about, but there already is a funded light rail system coming to downtown Fort Lauderdale. So one thing that this penny likely would be used for, and I call it a penny, it's really a 17% increase in sales tax that would generate billions.
Yep,
but
yep.
Anyway, one thing it would be used for would be to extend that light rail to other points in the county so that we could have a workable light rail system, but it also likely would be used for improving the bus system in a fashion that maybe someone that actually owns a car would choose to ride.
Yeah, Brittany, I'm with you. I don't think these things should be called pennies. They're a percentage sales tax. If you add 2%, was Broward 6% sales
6%
tax,
right,
if you
now,
do
yeah.
two of them,
yep.
That's a third increase in sales tax,
right.
Which... You know, I always say, like, a homeless person buying a T-shirt is paying this tax, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a tax that hits all sorts of people.
It's progressive, and that's one of the challenges is I think it's one of the taxes that everybody understands and everyone pays. A property tax, you know, renters are not paying, so they might go for.
Where would this tax money go? What would be the agency responsible for doling it out if voters approve it?
If the transportation tax is put on the ballot, it would 100% go to the county. And the county could spend it in any way, shape, or form, including on just operations and maintenance of existing transit. So that's something that's kind of dull to voters. They're not going to want to hear about that.
And that's something that has been an Achilles heel for transportation in Miami-Dade County for the better part of a decade. We'll leave it there, but we'll certainly revisit it in the weeks ahead. Brittany Wallman via Skype with us from the South Florida Sun Sentinel in Broward County, and Doug Hanks watching Miami County government for our partner, the Miami Herald. Thanks to both of you for joining us
this
week on the Florida Roundup.
Thanks.
Finally, on the roundup this week, it's been said that war is the way that Americans learn geography. Well, the fight on the campaign trail to be president provided its own location lesson this week.
It's morning again in America. Today, more men and women.
This was an ad for Senator Marco Rubio. It was supposed to evoke echoes of President Reagan's Morning in America campaign themes from the 1980s. Except Rubio's commercial opened with video of the skyline of Vancouver, Canada, at sunset. We'll do it for the Florida Roundup this week. We want to tell you we're all over social media. Look for us on Facebook and Twitter. Post your comments about today's program. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. The program is produced by Julia Duba and Alicia Zuckerman. Our program director here at WLRN is Peter J. Mertz. Our technical supervisor today, Paul Leary. Thank you, Mr. Leary. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Have a great weekend.